Lecture 64, June 4th, 1964. The Schrödinger Equation in a Classical Context, Superconductivity. Lecture 64, June 4th, 1964. The Schrödinger Equation in a Classical Context, Superconductivity. Lecture 64, June 4, 1964. The Schrödinger Equation in a Classical Context, Superconductivity.
For this last lecture, which is only for entertainment, again, I'd like to give a lecture in a somewhat different style, just to see how it works out. It's not part of the course in the sense that it's supposed to teach you something else in any last-minute effort, but rather I imagine I'm giving a seminar on a subject to a more advanced audience, that is, people who have been educated in quantum mechanics, and I want you to hear, you know, what the seminar would look like. Now, the main difference between that and a regular lecture is only this. In the seminar, people usually do not carry out all the steps and all the algebra and all the equations. They say, if you do this, this is what comes out, and that's where the thing will be all the time, instead of showing each time how it comes out. So that what I'll describe is the ideas all the way along and the results of all the equations and so on without, I mean, just realize you're not supposed to immediately understand how the thing comes out, but to believe more or less that if you did it, it would. The only difference between this and a regular seminar or research conference talk would be that I haven't prepared it well enough by looking up all the references. A good scientific talk is supposed to have the dates and names of everybody right, and I haven't got that. So aside from that, then this is a subject that I want to talk about which is completely recent and modern, and it would be a perfectly legitimate talk to give at the research conference. So I now begin as though I'm giving a research conference or something like that. And my subject is the Schrödinger equation in a classical setting, the case of superconductivity. Ordinarily, the behavior of the wave functions is something that applies only to one or two electrons or one or two particles. And the wave function itself is not something that has a classical meaning, unlike things like the electric field or the vector potential or things of this kind. There is a field, a wave function, which is a function of position for a single particle, which generally does not have a classical significance. Nevertheless, there are some situations in which it does, and those are the ones I would like to point out. The behavior, the quantum mechanical behavior of matter on a small scale that's so peculiar doesn't usually make itself felt on a large scale except in the standard ways of producing Newton's laws and the laws of mechanics or so-called classical physics. But there are certain situations in which the peculiarities of quantum mechanics can come out on a large scale in a special way. In low temperature physics, when the energy of a system has been reduced so very, very low so that instead of a large number of states being involved, only a very, very small number of states near the ground state is involved. Under those circumstances, the character of the ground state, the quantum mechanical character of that ground state, can come out on a macroscopic scale. So it's the purpose of this lecture to show a connection between quantum mechanics and classical effects, not the usual discussion of the way that quantum mechanics produces Newtonian mechanics, but a special situation in which quantum mechanics will produce its own characteristic effects, but on a large macroscopic scale. So I begin by reminding you about some of the properties of the Schrödinger equation. I'm not reminding you because I haven't shown you these before, but I'm in the spirit of this seminar. A thing that's very important in the Schrödinger equation for a single particle is the idea that the probability to find a particle at a position is given by the square of the wave function, the absolute square of the wave function. Now, it's characteristic of the quantum mechanics that the probability is conserved in a local sense. That is, if there's a certain chance to find the electron here, it isn't this way, that the probability of finding the electron here decreases and the probability of electron being here increases so that the total probability doesn't change without there being something going on in between. In other words, the electron has a continuity that if the probability of it being here decreases and builds up over there, there must be some kind of flow between. There's some, if you put something in the way, if you put walls in the way, for example, it won't be the same. There's an influence. It does not disappear in one place and appear in the other place. So the conservation of probability alone is not the complete statement of the behavior of this conservation law. Just like the conservation of energy alone is not as deep and as important as the local conservation of energy. If energy is disappearing here, there's a flow of energy to correspond. And in the same way, we would like to find a current of probability, such that if any change in the probability density, the probability of being found in a unit volume, occurs, it can be analyzed by being considered as a flow out due to some current. This current then could be interpreted this way, like the x component could be called the probability per second, or the net probability per second, that a particle passes in the x direction per unit area, say, across the yz plane. A passage this way considered plus, a passage this way considered minus, the net current of probability. Is there such a current? Well, we can calculate the rate of change of the probability by differentiating this and obtaining two terms. However, the derivatives of psi can be written in terms of the wave equation, and the derivative of psi star 2. Now, for some stupid reason, by pushing the blackboards around, I come out on the third board first. So I start the lecture over again with complete dopiness and begin further back. Excuse me. I want to describe the behavior of the Schrödinger equation in a magnetic field. I forgot to put the magnetic field in. So I have first to describe the Schrödinger equation in a magnetic field, because superconductive phenomena involve magnetic fields. The magnetic field is described, an external magnetic field is described by a vector potential, and the problem is, what is quantum mechanics in a vector potential? The principle that describes the behavior of quantum mechanics in a vector potential is very simple. The amplitude that any particle goes from one place to another, when there's a field present, is the same as the amplitude that would go from one place to the other along a particular route. When there's no field, multiplied by the exponential of the line integral of the vector potential times the charge divided by Planck's constant. In other words, the amplitude to go from B to A via a special route, and this also should be via a route, is this in the field is the same as without the field times e to the I times the line integral of the vector potential times Q over H. And that's a statement of the principles of quantum mechanics. Now, without the vector potential, the Schrödinger equation is that the derivative with respect to time is the operator, H on psi, and that the operator explicitly is 1 over 2m times H squared times the Laplacian plus Q times the potential. In an electric system, the potential will be the charge times the electrical potential. This statement is equivalent to the remark that the gradients are replaced in each case by QA, by the gradient minus QA. That this is true, I'd like to illustrate by a simple example in which, instead of having the continuous situation, we have a line of atoms, and we have an amplitude minus A. This is not the vector potential anymore, but it's just an amplitude minus A to jump from one atom to another if there were no field. Now, if there's a vector potential in the x direction, the amplitude to jump will be altered from what it was before, namely minus A, by a factor e to the I times the charge over Planck's constant times the vector potential integrated from one atom to the next. So our equations for those amplitudes will be the following. If Cn, or C of x, is called the amplitude to find the electron or atom at x, then the rate of change of that has three pieces. First, there's some energy if it were located at x times C of x. Next, there'd be the usual minus A times C of X plus B for the amplitude to have come from X plus B backwards. However, in doing so, in a vector potential, there is have to have the shifted phase because of this rule, which should be minus because we're going backwards, which is the line integral, which is the vector potential here, times the distance. I calculated to make it even more accurate, the vector potential in the middle, which is a good enough approximation to the integral. In the same manner, there's a certain amplitude to have jumped from the other side, but this time we need the vector potential a little bit on the other side times the distance. So that the equations in a vector potential for jumping from atom to atom are these. Now, we know that if the atoms are, if the function C is smooth enough, if we take the long wavelength limit and let the atoms get closer together in B and so on, that this will approach the behavior of an electron in free space. So the next step is to expand both sides of this thing in powers of B, assuming B very small. For example, if B is zero, then these are just the usual, and neglected here, then this is just minus 2a cx. So the zeroth approximation is e naught minus 2a cx. Next comes terms in B, but because this expression have B in the opposite sign, only even powers of B remain. And if you collect the terms by the Taylor expansion of everything to second order, we get this. Now, this horrible combination of things, which looks quite complicated, is mathematically exactly the same, it's written right down here, as AB squared times this, the ddx plus IA times ddx plus IA of C, meaning when you multiply it out, this, the second derivative plus IA times the first derivative plus the derivative of IA times C minus A squared times C. And you'll be easy to check that that's the same as that. If I remember that where there's no magnetic field, the limiting case of this situation is representing a particle with an effective mass, M effective, given by that formula. And if I take and borrow an H over I in each of these expressions, take out an I over H, I can write this as H over I ddx minus Q A sub x, going back to getting rid of the H by going back to the original vector potential. Thus it is so that this proposition that we have here, that the amplitude is changed by such a factor in moving from one point to another, is exactly the same as the standard rule that every gradient is replaced by every H over I gradient is replaced by Q A. That's what I was supposed to say first. Now I come back to this problem of the conservation of probability. Can you remember all the mumblings that I made? Okay, I make them now. So we look for a J such that dpdt is the divergence of J. And we calculate dpdt and now use the Schrodinger equation for d psi dt and the Schrodinger equation for d psi star dt. Now I haven't written a Schrodinger equation for d psi star dt, but it's obtained by taking a complex conjugate of this. And it makes a minus sign because of this I, which is changed in sign. Or there's some minus signs throughout this, I guess. And the H's over I's here get their sign reversed because of the complex conjugate. And then the terms here, E phi psi star psi from the one way of doing it, and psi E phi psi star, which is the other one, they'll cancel out. And in fact, a lot of stuff cancels out. And it turns out that the expression that's written here can indeed be written as a perfect divergence. It can be written as a divergence of 1 over 2m times a relatively long expression here. It isn't really so complicated, this expression. It's a symmetrical thing between an operation on psi and the same thing on psi star, so that the thing is real. And this operation can be remembered this way. H over I gradient is the usual operator momentum. So I can write the current, that this is the divergence of the current. There are some signs loose here, but it's all right. Is the average of 1 over m times p minus qa psi star psi, or the p minus qa on the psi first, either way. This then is an expression for the current and shows that the probability is conserved locally, and that a particle, if it disappears here, cannot appear over there without there being something going on in between. That we have to have the flow all the time. Because if the wave function is zero in between, so is the current. And if the current was, if the wave function never appeared to be here anything, was always zero, so that the probability of being here was always zero, and it was originally here something, then there's no current through this surface, and you can't find the probability over there. In other words, you can't get from one place to the other without going through the space in between, both in quantum mechanics and in classical mechanics. This business, however, this formula for the current is rather interesting and causes a certain amount of worry sometimes. We have two formulas. You see, you would think that the current would be something like the density of particles times the velocity. And the velocity, the density looks like the tube size, all right. And the velocity would be the momentum over m, and that would be okay, except for the vector potential. So that we have a kind of relationship here which looks like this. It looks as though the velocity times m is equal to the momentum operation minus the charge times the vector potential. Now, this is an operation in wave mechanics and is a kind of momentum. And it turns out, indeed, that in physics, in fact, already in classical physics, it was discovered that there were two ways of defining momentum. One of them is called a kinematic momentum, but for the purpose of this lecture, for absolute clarity, I'll call it the MV momentum, so you're pretty sure which is which, you see. Otherwise, we get mixed up. We have the MV momentum obtained by multiplying mass by velocity, and then we have a more mathematical, more abstract momentum, which is sometimes called the dynamical momentum, which I'll call P momentum, which you realize is connected in quantum mechanics to the gradient of the wave function, and the difference between those is the vector potential. I'd like to show you that what this is about, why there must be something like that in the quantum mechanics. According to the Schrödinger equation, the wave function changes with time in accordance with anything that I do here. If I therefore suddenly change the vector potential or do something of this nature, the wave function at first instance won't change. Only its rate of change changes. So that if I make a sudden change in vector potential in a situation, the wave function doesn't change. So I ask for the following circumstance. Suppose I have a circular tube, classically speaking, and a particle in it. And I put in here a flux. Instantaneously, I build it up from zero to something. In other words, I turn on the vector potential suddenly. I start with zero vector potential, then I turn on a vector potential. You remember that the line integral of the vector potential, by the way, around the circuit is the same as the flux of B through the center. Now, what happens if I suddenly turn on a vector potential? According to the quantum mechanical equation, the sudden change of A does not make a sudden change of psi. The wave function is still the same. So the P momentum is unchanged. So on a sudden turning on of this, the P momentum is unchanged. But what happens if I suddenly turn on a flux? During the time while I'm turning on that flux, during that very short time, there's an EMF, or electric field, generated whose line integral around, well, electric field is 1 over the circumference times the rate of change of the flux with time. That electric field is enormous if the flux is changing rapidly and gives a force to the particle. The force on the particle is the charge times the electric field. And so the particle, during the time interval, obtains from the force a momentum change per second equal to this, and during the entire time during which the electric field is put on, this is the MV which the particle acquires. The change in MV that the particle acquires is this integral. But since the phi dt is E, this becomes Q over M times the 1 over the circumference of the circle times the flux. But the flux is the line integral of the vector potential, the flux that's been turned on, which is the vector potential times the circumference. In other words, the change in MV is equal to Q. I say MV, I should have, this is a change in V because I divided by M, excuse me. The change in MV is QA. In other words, if you suddenly turn on a potential on a charge, it picks up an MV immediately, equal to A. But there is something that isn't changed immediately, and that's the difference between MV and A. And so the difference between MV and A, or the signs are reversed as usual, MV plus A plus QA is something which is not changed when you make sudden change in the vector potential. And so this quantity P is of importance in the theory of dynamics and already been noticed in classical mechanics, but has a direct significance in quantum mechanics. That is, it depends on the character of the wave function. If I change the vector potential and kept the wave function unchanged, I'll get a velocity, I'll get a current. Now, when Schrödinger first discovered his equation, he discovered this conservation law here as a consequence of his equation, and thought that this is a P and J. But he imagined incorrectly that this was the probability, not the probability. He didn't understand it in terms of probability. He assumed that this was the charge density of the electron, and that J was the current density of the electron, and that this was the way in which electrons interacted with the electromagnetic field. That when he solved his equations and calculated this psi. He wasn't calculating the probability of anything. There were no amplitudes in this. The interpretation was completely different. He didn't know what it was. So he interpreted the psi by saying the psi square is the charge density of the electron. The atom was sort of stationary with that charge density, or there was superpositions and complications. There were currents moving around, and that these charges and currents would then generate electric fields and the thing would radiate light and so on. He soon found on doing a number of problems that it didn't work out quite right. And it was Born, as a matter of fact, who really made the biggest contribution to our ideas with regard to quantum mechanics, because it's Born who correctly interpreted, well, as far as we know, but anyway, it's Born who interpreted the psi of the Schrodinger equation in terms of a probability amplitude. That very difficult idea that we've had so much trouble learning is due to Born, because the idea that the square of the thing is not the charge density, but is only the probability of finding an electron there, and that when you find the electron, the entire charge is where you find it. That whole idea, that new idea, is due to Born. On the other hand, there is a situation in which it could be that this is the charge density. Under certain circumstances, the wave equation for a single particle, you see, this isn't completely the charge density, because the electron doesn't have a smooth charge density when it's in an atom. It's either here or here or here, each with a little point charge. On the other hand, suppose we have a situation in which we have an enormous number of particles in exactly the same state. Very large number of them in exactly the same wave function. Then what? Well, then one of them is here, one of them is there. The probability of finding one of them at a given place is proportional to this. But since there are so many independent ones, if I look anywhere, the average number of them is this. So that psi star can be interpreted as the density of electricity in a situation in which psi is the wave function for one of an enormous number of objects which are all in the same state. Under those circumstances, in the same manner, if psi is so interpreted, this J will be the electric current, because the conservation law practically demonstrates that, because the charge density is related to the flow. So that in a situation in which we can have very many particles in exactly the same state, then there's a new physical interpretation of the wave functions, so that the charge density and the electric current can be calculated from the wave functions, and the wave functions take on a physical meaning which is expanded now into a classical situation or a macroscopic situation. That is a situation in which there is enormous numbers of particles, or big objects. An example of this is an equation which we haven't written down, which is the wave equation for a single photon, for finding the amplitude to find a single photon somewhere. That equation is a Maxwell's equation. The reason that the wave function in the case of photons, which is, turns out to be the vector potential, becomes in the classical physics the same thing and was already discovered by classical experiments is because photons are natural, uninteracting Bose particles, and many of them can be in the same state. And the moment you have billions in the same state in the same electromagnetic wave, then you can measure the wave function. You can measure the A. And so experimentally reversing the history, that is, in the ordinary run of history, you first observe situations in which many particles were in the same condition, and thus were able to discover the correct wave equation for a single photon by having observed directly with your hands on a macroscopic level the wave function for many, I mean a single photon, for many photons in the same state. Now, the trouble with the electron is that you cannot put more than one in the same state. And therefore, it was long believed that the wave function of the Schrodinger equation would never have a macroscopic representation analogous to the macroscopic representation of the amplitude for photons, which turns out to be the vector potential. On the other hand, it is now realized that the phenomenon of superconductivity presents us with just the situation that we want for this purpose. As you undoubtedly know, you undoubtedly don't know, but we don't know. Very many metals become superconducting below a certain temperature. The temperature is different for different metals. When you reduce the temperature sufficiently far, the metals conduct electricity without any resistance. This phenomena is not for all metals, but for a very large number of them. And the theory of this phenomena has caused a great deal of difficulty. It took a long time to understand what was going on inside. I will only describe what goes on inside enough for our own purposes here. It turns out that due to interactions with the lattice of the vibrating atoms, there's a net little attraction between the electrons. And the result is that the electrons form together, if I may speak very qualitatively and crudely, in pairs. Now, you see, a pair of electrons is a Bose particle. Because if I exchange two pairs, I change the wave function amplitude twice, but that means I don't change anything. And so a pair is a Bose particle. The energy of pairing, that is the desire for them to be in pairs, is very, very weak. So only a tiny temperature is needed to throw them apart and to get them back to normal. But when you get the temperature sufficiently low that they have to do their very best to seek the absolutely lowest state, then they do collect in this kind of pair. I don't wish you to imagine that the pairs are really held together very closely here and here and here. As a matter of fact, one of the great difficulties of understanding this phenomenon originally was that it is impossible. That's not the way the things are. These pairs are really rather very peculiar, that the positive and negative two electrons that form the pair are really both spread over considerable distance. And this pair is moving, and then there's another pair moving, and another pair moving, all in the same space at the same time. That is, the distance between the pairs is relatively smaller than the size of the pairs. The reason why they form pairs, an estimate of the energy needed to form the pairs, and so on, has been a triumph of recent times in the theory of Bardeen, Schrieffer, and Cooper in understanding the fundamentals of the superconductivity. And that is not the subject today. We will accept, however, the idea that the electrons in some manner or other do work in pairs, and that we can think of these pairs more or less as Bose particles. And therefore, we can talk about the wave function for a pair of electrons. I don't mean a two electrons, but the pair. Now, the Schrödinger equation for the pair of electrons will be more or less like this. There'll be a difference in that the Q will be twice the charge of an electron because it's a pair. Don't forget that, twice the charge of an electron. The mass, or the effective mass of a pair, we don't know. We don't know how much this inertia effectively is, so we don't know what number to put in here. Nor do we think that if we go to very high wavelengths, or very short distances, that this is exactly the right form, because if we get so much kinetic energy that corresponds to very rapidly varying wave functions, too rapidly varying wave functions, it may be that the energies involved are so great as to break up the pairs. At finite temperatures, there are a few pairs which are broken up by the usual Boltzmann theory that e to the minus the energy to break a pair over kT is the odds that one is broken. But I will consider the situation, those electrons which have broken out of pairs and not in pairs are called normal electrons because they behave with a normal resistance in ordinary way. I'm going to consider the situation at essentially zero temperature, or I'm just going to disregard the complications and side effects that are produced by those electrons which are not in the grand thing. You also know that in a Bose situation, there's an especially large amplitude if there's a lot of electrons in a given state for the other electrons to go in a given state. So these pairs will all lock down at the lowest energy in exactly the same state. It won't be easy to get one to go in not the same state. It's very much more amplitude that it wants to go in the same state as the others, the famous square root of n. So we have all the electrons, or rather all the pairs, moving in the same state. I think I'll have trouble saying it. I'll say electrons instead of pairs from time to time, but you understand. Later I'll put 2q for each one of these. But I think of it as electrons, but Bose electrons of charge 2. And of unknown mass, which I just call m in here. What then will our theory look like? Since psi star will now be proportional to the charge density, and I'll just say it is the charge density by normalizing it right, I can write my psi as a square root of the charge density times a phase, the charge density being real. And so it's interesting to see this. It's usually mumbled. It's easy enough to say you can talk about physically the charge density, but how can you ever talk about the phase of a wave function? Well, if we make this substitution and find the current density, Substituting in this expression for the current density, we can express the current density in these new variables instead of in terms of psi. It's just a change of variables. And making that substitution, we find that the current density that we were talking about before is rho, the charge density, times h over m, gradient theta minus q over h a, where theta was the phase. It comes from the derivatives of the wave function here. Thus, the phase is just as observable as rho, not the absolute phase, but the gradient of the phase, but that's except for a constant, essentially, the phase. Because you can fix the phase at one point, then the phase everywhere is determined. So that since the current density and the charge density are both physically realizable objects for this superconducting electron gas, both rho and theta are real things. And if you wish, you can do all your thinking in terms of rho and theta, or in terms of psi. Incidentally, this equation for the current can be analyzed a little more nicely. We can think that the current is, in fact, the charge density times the velocity of motion of the fluid of electrons, where this velocity is given by mv is h gradient theta minus qa. Notice the two pieces of mv momentum, one, the vector potential contribution, and the other, due to the wave function's behavior. Now you can describe some of the phenomena of superconductivity. First, there's no resistance, and there's no resistance because all the electrons are happily in the same state. In order to slow something down that's moving, the whole crowd moving together, if you get one guy out of the way at a time by little collisions, that's the way the thing is slowed down. In the ordinary flow of current, you knock one electron or another out of the regular way, gradually deteriorating the general momentum. But here, to get one electron away from what all the others are doing is very hard because of the tendency of Bose particles to all go in the same state. So the thing just keeps right on coasting. It's easy to understand that if you had a piece of material that was superconducting already by being brought below the critical temperature and put on a magnetic field that wasn't too great, I won't go into the details of how great and so on, after it's superconducting, that the field can't penetrate. Because as you try to build up the field, if any field were to build up in here, that would be a rate of change of flux, which would be an electric field. And an electric field would immediately generate a current by Lenz's law, which would oppose the flux. And so that a superconductor, when you turn the field on after you cooled it off, will exclude the field in this manner. But more interesting, and very interesting, and discovered experimentally by Meissner, an effect predicted, in fact, by London, was this. That if you have a superconductor, which is normal first, a high temperature, and put a magnetic field through so it goes right through the middle of the superconductor, and then lower the temperature to below the critical temperature, it pushes the field out by itself. In other words, it starts its own current, and just the right amount of current to keep the field out. I think we can see the reason for that in these equations already, and I'd like to explain that. Suppose that we take a piece of superconducting material, which is one lump, so. And then we notice that in this situation, that in a steady situation of any kind, the divergence of the current must be zero because there's no place for it to go. And I will also take, and I have to explain why it's valid, but I haven't the time, take a special gauge that the divergence of A is zero. Then I obtain the condition in here that the Laplacian of theta is equal to zero, because by taking the divergence of this J here, I get the Laplacian theta. One moment, what about the variation of rho? I forgot to mention an important point. There is a background of positive charge in this metal. Rho cannot accumulate without a terrific electrical repulsion pushing it back. So in ordinary circumstances, the charge density of the electrons in the superconductor is almost perfectly uniform, and rho is practically constant. So for that situation, then, the Laplacian of theta must be zero. Now, the only way that the Laplacian of theta can be zero everywhere in this side of this region is that theta be a constant. And that just means that there's no contribution from P momentum. And that means, and that means that the current is proportional to the vector potential times the charge times rho. It's proportional. This is practically a constant. So the current is proportional to the vector potential. Necessarily in a piece of material like this. And this means, then, that the Maxwell equations, which for steady conditions says that the Laplacian of A is proportional to the current, becomes the Laplacian of A is constant proportional to the vector potential in a superconductor. And if you chase the signs around, this constant is positive, so it's written lambda squared. Now, if we try to solve this equation, we see what happens, for example, in one dimension. This has exponential solutions, e to the minus lambda x or e to the plus lambda x, where lambda is a inverse distance. And that solutions come out to mean this, that when you put a magnetic field, the solution of the situation with a magnetic field present can only be that the vector potential decreases exponentially away from the surface. That's the only way. It can't increase because it would be a blow up. If the piece is large compared to 1 over lambda, very large compared to 1 over lambda, the vector potential decreases from the surface. So that aside from a thin layer on the surface, where the field in fact does penetrate, a layer of order 1 over lambda, the entire interior is free of field otherwise. And this is the explanation of the Meissner effect. So we have in our equations already some clues. This explanation and the theory of it was originally given by London many years ago. Now, however, in the recent times, there have been some more dramatic predictions. There were predictions, in fact, made by London, but so peculiar that nobody paid much attention. I will now discuss it. Suppose this time, instead of taking a solid piece, we take a ring. First, let's see what would happen if we started with a magnetic field through here. If we start with a magnetic field through here, and the ring is fairly thick compared to 1 over lambda and so on, and then turn on, let it go superconducting, it will push, the vector potential will decrease exponentially at the surface, and there will be zero vector potential in here. And there's zero, by the same kind of, this kind of equation, there's zero vector potential in here. So that in this region here, there is no vector potential. All the field is concentrated in here and in here. Excuse me, that's not quite right. What there is nothing in there is there's no current in there. Now that is also, yes, there's no current. There's no current in the interior. If you solve these equations in this case, you find that the current in the interior must be zero. And the current, so that if I were to take the line integral of the current all the way around the circuit, I get an interesting effect. There is current in the ring. The current is all on the surface. Those currents are the currents which are trying to keep the field out of the ring. They don't balance out. There's a net current in the ring. But in the interior of the ring, there's zero current. And being zero current, where this is the expression for the current, we see that the line integral of H times the gradient of theta must equal the line integral of A times dS times Q. Now, the line integral of the gradient of theta around any closed thing is the difference in theta from one end to the other. And in a simple closed material, this is the flux. Integral of that is the flux. Now, in a simple closed solid material, if we go around from point to point, the theta will come back to its old value. But if we go around in a ring, we can't guarantee that. The wave function is given by the square root of rho e to the I theta. But when we go all the way around, it's possible that the theta has varied by a multiple of 2 pi. The function is the same, but the theta may have changed by 2 pi n. So that means that h times 2 pi n must be q times phi. In other words, in such a ring, the flux, which is finally captured, must be an integral multiple of a certain amount. The flux must always be a number n times 2 pi h over q. Q, however, is twice the charge on electron. London predicted that flux would be quantized and supposed that it would be given by this formula with a 1 in here. But the pair theory explained better what was going on. And this comes out to be a relatively small but not impossible amount of flux. It is, in fact, coming out something like this. It comes out 2 times 10 to the minus 7 Gauss centimeters squared. To make it more realistic to you, if we took a very tiny object, a tenth of a millimeter across, the field that corresponds to a flux of one of these units is 2% of the Earth's field. The Earth's field is quite substantial, and 2% of the Earth's field easily controlled and measurable amount. Therefore, this is within the range of experiment, and three or four years ago, it was done. Because this is a purely quantum mechanical thing, but on a large scale. It says that the flux in a little ring, a tenth of a millimeter, you know, a tenth of a millimeter is an enormous thing from an atomic level. That the flux involves Planck's constant. The experiment was done this way, by evaporating a superconductor on a wire of material that was not, a very fine wire of material that was not superconducting, such a ring was made. Then the ring was put in an arbitrary magnetic field, small, controlled field, and the temperature reduced until it became superconducting. Then a certain amount of flux was trapped inside here, which we expected to be integral multiples of something. Then the external field was removed. In taking away the external field, nothing can happen this is a superconductor. If I take away the external field, it just generates a current by Lenz's law so that the flux inside never changes. So now we have a thing which has a flux inside. It's a little object with a magnetic moment. And the amount of magnetic moment is proportional to the flux inside. So what we say here is for these dimensions, the magnetic moment of this thing has to be quantized. Now, its magnetic moment was measured by putting it on an instrument, something like a sewing machine needle that could go up and down very fast in a coil, and picking up the EMF to measure how much magnetic moment is left. This is done by Fairbanks and company, and they discovered, indeed, that the flux that they measured each time was one or another of units. The unit was half as great as was expected at the time, and at first this was quite mysterious. However, there's a great man in the theory of solid state called Ansager, who never makes himself clear, but has always said, if you look it up later, exactly what's true. Somewhere he had said, the flux quantization of London should be in half units. He never said why he thought so or anything, but now, of course, we understand it in terms of the Bardeen theory of pairs. But why he said that and what he was thinking, nobody knows, but he predicted it. At any rate, these are two confirmations of our general ideas, and I would like, just for the sake of completeness, to show you what the complete equations of a superconducting fluid would be from this point of view. It's rather interesting. If I make this substitution into the complete Schrodinger equations, I've only put it into the current here and into the density. If I put it into the complete Schrodinger equation, I get equations for rho and theta, and it's interesting to see what kind of a thing that represents. Because here we have a fluid with a density and a mysterious theta. And the question is, then it would be some kind of fluid equations for it. So I substitute this form in the Schrodinger equation and separate, remember that rho and theta are real, and separate real and imaginary parts, obtaining then two equations. If I call for short V equal H over M grad theta minus Q over M A, in the sense then that J must be rho V, one of the equations that I obtain when I make the substitution is just back again this conservation law. The other equation that I obtain is an equation which determines how theta varies. Those who are thoroughly familiar with hydrodynamics, of which I'm sure none of you are, will recognize this as the equation for the vector potential of a system in a magnetic field. Well, I have no magnetic field. It doesn't make any difference of a charged current, of an electrically charged fluid. The rate of change is given by the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. However, there's an additional, typically quantum mechanical force. In our applications, inside of a superconductor, the rho, because of electrical effect, is so nearly constant that this term can almost certainly be neglected in every practical application, provided it's the same superconductor from place to place. In junctions between different superconductors under other circumstances where the rho value must change rapidly, this term will become important. This equation for theta is not very transparent, but since V is connected to theta by the gradient, by taking the gradient of this equation, I obtain an equation for the rate of change of V. And I've written that equation this way, dV dt plus V dot gradient V. On this side. The reason is that dV dt, the rate of change of the velocity at a given point, is not the acceleration of a particle. The acceleration of a particle is the rate of change of the velocity if you ride along with the particle. And so you have to compare the velocity at different points as you go along. And when you work that out, it means it's not just the derivative at this point, but it's this particular combination. So this is called a co-moving acceleration. And it turns out that the equation says that the acceleration is equal to q over m plus e plus v cross b, where the e and the b are obtained in a normal way from the a and the phi, minus the gradient of this mystic new force, which is not very big in most circumstances in the superconductor except at junctions. So here we have an equation of a fluid with a force on it. It's just a charged fluid in electric and magnetic fields. Its charge density is conserved. And there's one extra condition. It's a perfect fluid in such a field. That is, the curl of the, it has zero rotation. It comes from a vector, the velocity comes from a vector potential. With no magnetic field, that would be curl V equals zero. In a magnetic field, a perfect fluid is a different law, and this is well known for charged, that for charged fluids, the perfect fluid is one for which the curl of V is always equal to the magnetic field. At any rate, what I'm trying to say is that this pair of equations is really the same, surprisingly the same, as Schrödinger's equations. It's rather amusing that these equations were noticed by Kendall in 1928, and he tried to make a hydrodynamical model of the Schrödinger equation, tried to get a model of the Schrödinger equation which he could understand instead of all these crazy probability amplitudes. But nobody ever used it for anything because it was the wrong interpretation. But now we must return to these. Coupled with these equations, a person who wants to make a theoretical physics analysis of superconductors would take this pair of equations and these, which are the Maxwell equations, where the charge and the current comes from the superconductor stuff. Of course, I should always add the charges and other currents, naturally. I forgot to write those on. Incidentally, also, technically, as far as I can tell, there ought to be perhaps a gradient pressure term. For example, if this is applied to superfluid helium, in which we have helium atoms, which are also Bose particles, but they're not charged, then all these terms disappear here. But it is true that there are interactions between the atoms, and if they're compressed in too small a density, there's an extra force, which is not taken into account when you deal with independent particle approximation. And I believe that the energy which results from the change of density will appear as a pressure term in exactly the same way as it does for ordinary fluids, that the quantum mechanical fluid would have this term in its case of superfluid helium plus a pressure gradient term. Now the next case, the next situation I would like to discuss is a very interesting one that was noticed by Mr. Josephson in analyzing a junction between two superconductors, a very, very fine junction of non-superconducting material. Now, if we have two superconductors which are connected by a sufficiently thin layer of non-superconductor, if this layer was thick enough, that's insulating material. The electrons can't get out through the insulating material. But a typical quantum mechanical thing is that if you're not allowed to be in here, and if it isn't too far that you have to go, there is a certain amplitude to get across. Flip-flop, okay? So he analyzed this situation and has discovered a number of strange phenomena should occur if two superconductors are connected by a sufficiently thin layer of insulator. That's called it nowadays a Josephson junction, and I'm going to analyze it. In order to analyze it, we suppose, for simplicity, that the amplitude to find the electron here is called psi 1 and here is psi 2. No, my habit is too strong. Psi 1 and psi 2 is the wave function for the common wave function of all the electrons in this material, and psi 2 is the corresponding one over there. And I can do this problem for different kinds of superconductors, but let us take a very simple situation that the material is the same on both sides, so it's very symmetrical and simple. And also, for a moment, that there be no magnetic field in this direction. Then the rate of change of the amplitude of psi 2, this is just the Schrödinger equation for a flip-flop, see, is minus A times the amplitude to be at 1, plus whatever energy it would have in state 2. If the materials are equal, that energy will be the same in both, and I subtracted it away. But I'll suppose that we have, because we can by connecting wires and so on, arrange a potential difference phi between the two. So there's an energy difference for electrons here and here, or rather for a pair here and here, a 2 QE over phi. There is a voltage across this insulating junction. So I've split the energy, I say, on the one side. If it's on this side, it's minus V over 2, and on the other side, plus V over 2. My signs may be wrong. I won't bother about that. So here's the energy of a particle in system 2, and here's its amplitude to have come from the other side. Here's the amplitude to be on this side. It comes from the other side a certain amount per second, and if it's here, it changes because of the energy there. This is standard equations for two objects interfering, which you must be sick by this time. However, it's fun because it's the same equations over and over, and we can get a lot of physics out of it. So if we put psi 1 equals, now this time, in order to understand these equations in another way, we suggest putting psi 1 as the square root of rho 1 e to the I theta, and psi 2 as the square root of rho 2 e to the I theta 2, where theta 1 and theta 2 are the phases at these two points of these amplitudes, and rho 1 and rho 2 are the density of electrons at those two points. Also, for shortening the work here, I've called delta theta 2 minus theta 1, the difference in phase. It comes in, all the equations are simple in terms of delta. Also, I call your attention to the fact that in actual practice, the rho 1 and rho 2 are almost exactly the same and equal to rho 0, the normal density of electrons in the material, because of the electrostatic effects that would be produced if you tried to take some of them away. Now, if you substitute these two things in here, you get four equations by taking the real and imaginary part in each case. One of the equations says that rho 1 dot is equal to this business in terms of sine delta. The other says that rho 2 dot is equal to the negative of the same thing. Now you say yes, and then rho 1 dot is 0 because rho 1 is nearly rho naught and so on. But I would rather interpret this a little bit better. Rho 1 dot is given by this must mean that this is the flow of charge through this surface. That, in other words, must be the current across the junction. Because it would be, in the analysis that we've made here, any flow across would mean a decrease in the density here. So this must be the current. I believe, therefore, I deduce from this that the current across that junction is given by this formula. Since rho 1 and rho 2 are nearly rho naught, this is essentially a constant times sine delta. The constant depends upon A, therefore on how the junction is made, and varies from junction to junction. Let's call it J naught for this junction. In actual fact, the rho 1 will not change this way because I'm going to supply from the other side. I haven't talked about what happens to the other end of the wave function, but we can supply with electrical instruments a supply of current to take up the current which flows away so that the actual charge density does in fact not change. In other words, rho 1 would change this way if this were only thing that affected psi, but I'm feeding stuff in from the side. So I interpret this as a current, and then I know this is the current that I have to feed in order to keep the rho constant. The other pair of equations give equations for the theta 1 and theta 2. The only thing that's interesting to me, it turns out, I mean, it's not important, the theta 1 plus theta 2. The only thing that's important to connect the equations together is the delta, or difference. It turns out by subtracting these two equations that you find that delta dot is just the voltage. The current at any moment is J naught times the sine of this phase difference. The phase difference changes with time proportional to the voltage, and therefore the current at any time is given by J0 sine delta naught plus 2QE times the integral of VDT. Now, what are the consequences? First, put on a DC voltage. If you put on a DC voltage, this becomes VT. And that means that it's sine of something oscillating very, very rather rapidly. And the net current is nothing. So if you put a voltage on, you don't get anywhere. Actually, you do. You get some current due to the normal conduction and so forth. Normal electrons and a lot of complications. But if you have absolutely zero voltage across, you can get a current. You can get a current with no voltage. The current can be any amount up to a maximum J naught of either sine, because delta can be solved that way. It can't be any higher than J naught. So you can get currents through this thing with no voltage drop. And those currents reach a certain maximum. If you try to put a voltage across it, it doesn't work. However, the current should oscillate at an enormous frequency. And one can deduce that this is true by also adding to the DC voltage an AC voltage and looking for a kind of resonance between the two. I haven't the time to, it's very easy to write down the extra term, do the AC term and expand it out and show that there is a mean J under those circumstances if you get exactly the right frequency. In other words, if your AC voltage that you put on is just the frequency given by 2QE over H times the DC voltage, then you get a mean current through the junction. And this has been tested. Currents through the junction with AC on top of DC have been measured only, I believe, a half a year ago. This whole theory of the junction was made only a year and a half or 2 years ago. Now, this experiment was made only half a year ago, and it just found, indeed, that the currents do go when the frequency is just right, according to the DC voltage, according to this equation. So we have, therefore, a direct macroscopic measure of our little theory of flip-flopping around between two states. I want one other thing that the general, if you look in the books on the subject, or there's no books, if you look in the papers on the subject, you find that they also write the formula for the current sine of delta plus 2QE times the integral of the vector potential averaged across the, well, across the junction, averaged over the face of the junction. The reason for this is
that when there's a vector potential along the junction, the flip-flop amplitude is modified in phase in the way that we explained for a line of atoms here, that we just have this extra phase. And if you chase that extra phase through, it comes out over here. That way I don't need it, but since the equation appears all the time in that format instead of in this simple form, I have to show you how it comes. Now, finally, a very dramatic and interesting experiment has been made on the interference of flow between two junctions. In quantum mechanics, we're used to the interference between two different slits, and now we're going to do the interference between two different slits by comparing the phase of the arrival of the currents through the two different loops. So we have here two different lines connected between P and Q, where we have our electrical instruments to see if we can get any current through and how much we can get. This current, J total, can be considered as a sum of the two effects from the two junctions. I'll imagine these two junctions are infinitesimally wide, very simple junctions. They're actually a little complicated, more complicated, but it's hard to make them infinitesimally wide, but I mean this way wide. These two junctions will be called A and B, the currents J A and J B, and let the phases be delta A and delta B. Now, the phase difference for the electrons which go around through here, to get from the phase difference between electron at this point and this point is the same whether you go on this route or on that route. And so therefore the phase difference between points P and Q is either delta A plus that piece of the line integral of the vector potential along the upper route. Why? Because in a quantum mechanical system, the amplitudes vary by the line integral of the vector potential, if there's a vector potential on top of things. And the other way is the other line integral on the lower root. If these two must be equal and I subtract them, it says then that the difference of the deltas must be the line integral around the circuit. So the two deltas are going to differ by an amount which is equal to Q over H times the flux through the circuit. And this amount is an amount I can control by changing the magnetic field on the circuit. So I can adjust the differences in phases and see whether or not the amount of current that flows through truly interferes between these two junctions in a situation which I can adjust the phase. The total current will be the sum of the two, which will be sine delta plus the phase, I mean the flux, and the usual way of combining two such waves. You take the sine of half the sum and the cosine of half the difference. Now, delta A was arbitrary, and nature can adjust it any way she wants. So the maximum current that could flow in this thing, with no, there are no voltages on it, the maximum current is given when you adjust the delta A so that this term is maximum, is given then by 2J naught times the size of this term. For instance, if this phase was such that this term was necessarily zero, you can get no current through the junction. So the amount of current through the junction should go so. Now, beside that current, there's the regular currents from losses due to normal materials and so on and so on, so that actually the curve that's obtained is one that looks like this. And it has been done. And the paper published is on February 17th, 1964, which brings us within 2 months of today. I would like to know if in a minute or two, which I haven't got, say the future of these experiments. First, there's one more paper which has just been published, which does this. One of the wonderful things about quantum mechanics is the question of whether the vector potential exists in a place where there's no field. And this experiment has been done with a tiny solenoid wound in here in which the only magnetic field is in this region. There's no field anywhere on the wires. And yet, the amount of stuff that flows through depends oscillatorily on the amount of magnetic field inside that solenoid, even though that solenoid, that field never touches these wires. A definite, real demonstration of the physical reality of the vector potential. Next, what comes next, I don't know. The patent office is probably getting ready. The papers and the experiments are getting ready. Look what can be done. Suppose, for example, we put a whole set of junctions close together. I mean, arrange them. Here's a whole set of junctions, equally spaced, beautifully equally spaced, 10, 20 junctions. Then we will have the interference between 10, 20 slits. And then we'll have, as we change the magnetic field, a very sharp maximum and minimum instead of these rapid bumps. Instead of a 2-slit interference, we have a 20 or 100-slit interference. and we have a kind of interferometer for magnetic field. When the magnetic field is just right, zoom, we get a current, otherwise nothing. So it's going to be, we can predict, that the measurement of magnetic fields is going to become almost as precise as the measurement of wavelengths of light. The discovery of interference of light permitted that you could count fringes and measure distances up to millions of fringes. So magnetic fields now, or fluxes more precisely, can be measured, I believe, soon to millions and millions of units, you know, parts in 10 million, 100 million, by this method of counting bumps. These, then, is some illustrations of something which is happening in modern times, again and again, with the laser, with the transistor, with these junctions whose practical application is still not known. The quantum mechanics, which was discovered in 1926, has had, for nearly 40 years, of gestulating, or whatever it is, gestation, until it has reached the realities of practical and real applications. We are really getting in control of nature on a very delicate and beautiful level, and it's therefore absolutely imperative, I'm sorry to say, gentlemen, that you must learn quantum mechanics as soon as possible. Thank you very much. Here's a paper I forgot to say with the oscillations on top of another current. This is the rapid, these are bumps. This curve is because these junctions aren't infinitesimally thick. And it's like the diffraction pattern from wide slits. And when he makes a junction wider, he gets a diffraction pattern from a wider slit. So it's just like the diffraction pattern between slits.
Benzene is also a superconductor.
I don't know. People have suggested that might be the case, but I don't think so. I don't really know. I'm sorry. After all, it would be a superconductor in a circle, and it's hard to get out to find out what it is.
You said they oscillate at a very rapid frequency. What kind of frequency?
Well, I can't remember, because it depends on... I didn't get the numbers. I don't have the numbers in my head. They're rather technically quite difficult to do the experiment. You have to have a small voltage carefully controlled, and then you put the other voltage on at high frequencies. It's in a mega cycle somewhere. Does anybody know what frequency this... is any of you low temperature guys? Nobody's here. Know what frequency this was done? I don't know. Let me show you, as long as you're bothered to ask, though, not tell you the frequency, but why it is that, I guess you don't need, that the AC permits a current to flow when you have a DC on, would you? It's like this. It's sine. Yeah. What? That's a DC voltage. And then there's the AC, which would be something like V1 cosine omega t over omega or something when you integrate it. All times 2QE over 8. Now this function, I'll expand it in two pieces. I mean approximations. I get this without disregarding that, and then I get another term from the derivative. And then this thing, you see, what is it? If you take this to be small, V1 cosine omega t over omega, and so on. Now, if this omega is just right with this, this thing has a non-zero average, so the average current keeps going. It's an oscillating thing, like a kid on a swing that you push at just the right moment, it keeps on going. But I don't know, I haven't got the paper in front of me. That's what I said, it was poor preparation. I haven't got the paper with the numbers of the frequencies and so on. I think it has.
I think some people have claimed to indirectly.
I saw a paper, but I didn't read it too carefully, that had measured, had seen it. But perhaps it's not a satisfactory experiment.
I was just talking to Marcio about it.
Oh, well, then he must know. Probably there was a mistaken interpretation. It was complicated and quite sloppy, the experiment. It was hard to be sure. So perhaps that hasn't been measured yet.
Is this frequency in the megacycle?
What frequency is it? Thousands of megacycles for a controllable voltages. Yeah.
Maybe it will find me during the lecture.
Yes.
I was wondering, did you derive the breakdown of superconductivity under the field?
I can, but I didn't. It didn't pass you in the lecture, but I was in a hurry and I didn't. The situation is this. It's really quite simple. If you exclude the field, as this will exclude it, then that field energy is increased because the fields are closer together and larger in this region. This is of more energy than a uniform field. Now, there's a certain amount of difference in energy between the normal condition and the condition where they've all formed in pairs, a certain amount of energy that's a character of the material. And if that energy is not enough to get the field out, I mean, if it's not enough, then the thing just comes back in, you see, and it doesn't work. Actually, the energy difference between the normal condition and the superconducting condition starts at zero at the critical temperature and rises. And therefore, what this actually does is that any field will reduce the critical temperature. You understand? Because it takes a little bit, you got to get a little bit below before you got enough energy to kick it out. So there's a curve, which is critical temperature versus magnetic field, which looks something like this. This is the critical temperature at zero field here, and as you increase the field, the temperature goes down. But there's a certain also so-called critical field, so that if you got too much field, that's bigger than the difference even at absolute zero, and it never can get it. Understand? So this is the result. I didn't say it in the lecture, but because I had so many things that I couldn't. Yes. The amount of energy, incidentally, is very easy to calculate. It's 1 over 8 pi times the square of the magnetic field times the volume, and that gives all the theory of this curve completely, that idea that energy per unit volume in the material difference between super and normal is given by this, where this is a critical field. And it's an easy theory. Yeah.
Very nice. But it must occur to me why rho 1 and rho 2 must necessarily be the same.
Well, I said let the materials be the same.
Oh, okay.
If they're not the same, then I have to work it over again, but they can do it over again.
Okay,
you can do it over again.
I said, the same material, that's right. But for two different materials, they're quite different.
They could be, and then you have to think it over again. That's quite right. And the junctions of two different materials are a little different than material. But I want to make the simplest example to understand.
That's fantastic.
Isn't that wonderful?
They're going to have
I think they appreciated it at the end. I hope.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I don't know if Gary saved any soul or
not. You might be interested to know there's maybe a couple of more experiments.
Done one more experiment.
What?
Which is measuring the de Broglie wavelength of an electron.
Oh, by measuring the shift due to the current. The theta MV,
exactly.
This thing.
Yeah.
Good. I should have mentioned. I didn't know that, or I would have mentioned it. But that isn't published yet.
No. Well, it's been submitted, but it's...
Oh, it would have been great to tell about a submitted paper. I'm sorry I didn't have it.
I tried to get here.
Yeah. I'm sorry,
I didn't have this report.
Yeah. I've been trying to get Hildebrand all this time. If I'd have known you guys had this stuff, I wouldn't have bothered. But I've been wasting time. He wasn't around, until the last minute when somebody else called up and says, should we come to this lecture? I says, yeah, and tell me something, too.
That was very good, sir.
Okay.
With this interference deal with the many slits, or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
The magnetic field is meant to be very uniform. You get the same
phase. Yes. Yes. Yes, you can't go to enormous fields, but... But the thing can be made fairly small. I mean, it's like you could make a grating in which you cracked lines open into onto a sheet of metal of some superconducting metal by scratching lines, then filled it with an insulator, and then glued another piece of metal against it.
Well,
through the evaporate layer, and then put evaporate layer of the junction material, and then put another metal sheet on top. And then have nicely, evenly spaced lines very close together on a relatively short region, hundreds of lines. Okay, it's even easier to insulate oxidizers. And you could imagine that you could make this thing relatively easily.
I find myself erroneously thinking of...
Large scale.
The current's going off in different directions as with light. No, it isn't that. It's that the current is passed or not passed according to whether the phases add up properly.
That's right.
For each of the things. You get
That's
great
right.
maxima and small freeze
and
all kinds of things that look like what you get for the diffraction of light, but it'll be like sort of analog.
You change the magnetic field as though you were sweeping around the angle.
Yeah.
No way to get the direction out.
In order to get the gain off that you're talking about, merely the theoretical, you have to go to very, very small junctions. Otherwise, the self-fueling this current produces
a lot of things I've tried to point out. The reason I said about this was for you guys. I put this in because I wanted to sit. It's
from the integration
across here, and you have to calculate it from the current side. But the thing that's interesting, it seemed to me, that I noticed when, see, they got these papers and we're comparing this stuff, that it's all in these equations. Actually, these equations themselves carried across the junction will also work. If you add a term in here for energy of location that's varying, that's here very high, like a repulsive potential, and solve this there, right across the junction, it's the same thing. Only I didn't do that. I used something that they already knew. There's some energy to go across. The reason for that is we don't know what J naught is anyway. The theory of calculating the size of A would go back to the original Schrodinger equation.
Okay.